Arthritis is one of the most painful kinds of degenerative diseases that we have in our country. In fact, I think that the most amount of Social Security benefits are being paid out prematurely for people with arthritis. Very painful, and once you have it, it just continues to get worse. There's three principal kinds of arthritis that many of us know about. One is gouty arthritis. Now, gouty arthritis is something that simply comes from eating too much animal protein or too many organ meats. And it's a problem that happens when the uric acid level rises in your blood. And these come from those kinds of substances. Now, the problem with uric acid, it's perfectly normal constituent in the blood, but if it rises too high, the blood can't keep it in solution, and it forms crystals, uric acid crystals. Uric acid crystals are completely unnatural in the body's scheme of things. And when uric acid crystals form, the first thing that happens is that your white blood cells, seeing these strange crystals, know they're not supposed to be there, and so they eat them. Your white blood cells are trained to eat anything foreign in the blood. If you have bacteria, you have viruses, cancer cells, defective red blood cells, the white blood cells will eat them to make the blood nice and clean. And so it does with uric acid crystals. Now normally, these little red white blood cells have little stomachs in them called lysosomes. These stomachs are powerful in digestive juices. Digestive juices are even more powerful than your stomach acid where you digest your food. Your stomach can't digest, for example, fat, but these little stomachs in the white blood cells can digest just about everything. And they eat the uric acid crystal, and it gets in their little stomachs, but unfortunately never in nature's experience was it ever intended for a white blood cell to eat a uric acid crystal. The crystal with those little sharp points punctures the little stomachs because they're just indigestible, and the digestive juices from the little stomachs pour out in the cell. The cell then is digested by its own juices, and the digestive juices spill out into the joint spaces. When it spills out in the joint spaces, the juices now start to attack the joint itself, and that's your attack of gout. When you have attacked by your own little digestive juices in the white blood cells come out because you're destroying the white blood cells, that's the attack on your joint spaces. This happens so fast that it only takes less than an hour from the time a white blood cell eats a uric acid crystal until a white blood cell is destroyed and all the juices then are poured out, attacking the joints in the body itself. So it's very simple to handle that problem. Simply cut your uric acid level down by stop eating the tremendous amounts of animal protein that can raise uric acid level. Uric acid is simply a byproduct of eating protein. It's a protein breakdown product. A couple of years ago, 100 years ago in England, gout was absolutely epidemic among those that can afford it. That's because if you look at their menus, you can see they used to have six kinds of animal protein for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. In the morning, they have bluebird pie or blackberry pie, blackbird pie, that is, and different kinds of meats and fishes. That's all they used to eat if you're rich enough to afford it, and so gout was really epidemic. We know how to get rid of gout. How about rheumatoid arthritis? This is a real crippler and a real problem. And rheumatoid arthritis is related to the same kind of system, the white blood cell. Now, it used to be thought that rheumatoid arthritis was an infectious problem, somehow happened due to infection. And the reason for that is that when a young child used to get rheumatoid fever, rheumatic fever, they used to have a temporary arthritis that developed and lasted for a period of months. And it was thought that, therefore, infection must be the factor in rheumatoid arthritis. And many people used to have their teeth pulled out so that they would avoid the possibility of having an infected tooth. 20, 30, 40 years ago, I can't tell you how many people had every tooth pulled out of their mouth to avoid arthritis, wearing false plates, completely without any reason, because it was all so unnecessary. They used to have their tonsils taken out, anything to avoid infections, to avoid arthritis. It never made any difference. The problem in rheumatoid arthritis It is again related to the white blood cell, because if the white blood cell has inadequate oxygen, and in rheumatoid joints the oxygen level is very low, the little stomachs in the white blood cell, the lysosomes, can swell up so much so they can burst. And when they burst, again, the juices go into the cell, dissolve the cell, destroy the cell, and the juices now, after they dissolve the cell, they get out into the joint areas and attack the joints. And when they attack the joints, they start to nibble, those the juices start to dissolve on your own joint lining, on your synovial lining. When other white blood cells around see your synovial lining being attacked, they assume it's bad tissue and they start to eat it too. So you can have attack on your own synovial lining by your own white blood cells if it doesn't look well. The only hope there is to stop the very low oxygen level. That happens because you have two things happen to you. First, you're on a high-fat diet. The high-fat diet causes your red blood cells and other little cells to clump, so they can't get through small capillaries, and the clumping itself causes the oxygen not to be able to be picked up by the sides of the red blood cells that are stuck together. The other thing that happens is they clump together, the capillaries are blocked, and so the blood flow is cut down and the oxygen carrying capacity of the tissues is lessened. Smoking, of course, would help cut down the oxygen capacity of the red blood cell, since the carbon monoxide of the smoke paralyzes the red blood cell for a period of time. All these help do it. And when they block the small vessels, what happens is that the body, under the pressure of the heart pumping blood, goes against the blockage, and when it can't get through, it pushes the blood right through the sides of the capillary walls. This floods the tissues, causing what we call edema, flooding of the tissues with fluid. And the edema makes it difficult for the oxygen to transfer to the various cells, and makes it difficult for the oxygen to be given to the white blood cells where they need it. So that anyone that has rheumatoid arthritis is going to have a certain amount of fluid in the tissues. In fact, we know by experiments that if you increase the fluid in the tissues, that people will have a greater incidence of arthritis than if you have less fluid in the tissues. For example, in cases of women who have taken the German measles vaccine, because German measles, if you have it during pregnancy, can cause malformation of the child. If you give German measles vaccine to a young girl, 5, 6, 10 years old, they might have 1 out of 200 cases where they'll have a temporary outbreak of arthritis. And that's because the virus in the vaccine is a little bit indigestible with your white blood cell. And you can lose a few white blood cells, and when you do, the juices of the stomach get out and cause this temporary arthritis by inflaming the joints. But you get someone who is older, 15, 20 years old, instead of 1 out of 200, because as you get older and you continue eating the normal fat meals in our country, you always have more and more blocked vessels and more edema. A 15 or 20-year-old female could have, instead of 1 out of 200 arthritis, can have 1 out of 50, 1 out of 25. By the time you get to be 25 or 30 and you're a female in this country, if you take the German measles vaccine, 1 out of 4 will get a temporary arthritis, because by the time you're 25 or 30, you have so much fat in your blood that you have quite a bit of edema. And this is very interesting. If you take the German measles vaccine right before menstruation, when you have a premenstrual edema, instead of 1 out of 4 having arthritis, 1 out of 2 will have a temporary arthritis. To show you the power of the extra edema, the extra fluid stopping and blocking the transfer of oxygen. Edema is very important to development of arthritis. When you already have a high fat blood level and edema from that, and then if you have extra edema from injury or from natural means like premenstrual edema, or taking birth control pills, they create edema. Women with birth control pills always have more arthritis than those who don't take it. If you have an injury like women used to scrub floors on their knees, and remember the term housemaid knee? That's no joke. But that's from the trauma from being on your knees on a hard surface floor. It creates an edema from the injury, and that's where they used to get some arthritis. People that use air hammers to break up concrete, they always usually have some arthritis in their hands because the trauma of the air hammer creates an edema of inflammation in their hands, and that's where the arthritis will start. So if you have an injury and where you get edema plus a lot of blockage from your high-fat diet, you're on your way to rheumatoid arthritis. Osteoarthritis is a little bit different, but it still involves a white blood cell. And studies have indicated that when the white blood cell is destroyed because of the lack of oxygen, where these lysosomes, the little stomachs, blow up and all their digestive juices come out, if these digestive juices come into contact with the cartilage cell, that's the cells that grow this nice, firm, tough tissue on your joints. If they come in contact with the cartilage cell, these stomach juices from these little white blood cells will cause the cartilage cells to make a bad kind of cartilage, a bony kind of cartilage. And they'll actually make a bony kind of cartilage that we call osteoarthritis. The osteo, of course, is a bone kind of arthritis where instead of a nice flexible lining around your bones, it's a bone-like, made by your own cartilage cells. So again, the problem is the fat in the diet and the possible edema with other things joining in. The treatment for arthritis is medieval. What do they do when you have arthritis? Well, the first thing they might do is give you cortisone. What does cortisone do? Cortisone sort of paralyzes your white blood cells so they can't work. Well, when that happens, they also can't eat bacteria and viruses to get rid of infections. So if you're on cortisone, if someone sneezes 50 feet away, you're going to catch cold. It's the fastest way to get infections if you're on cortisone. And cortisone has a lot of other problems. But by tying up your white blood cells so they're inactivated, then they won't be able to spill their little stomach juices all over your joints and you'll feel a little better. There's another way to help your arthritis called lymphocyte depletion. That's another medieval idea with scientific overtones. They go into your lymph vessel, the big thoracic vessel, and they take the white blood cells out by the hundreds of millions. They drain them out and they separate the white blood cells out and send back the fluid in the body. So in the first 24 hours, you can have a couple, maybe 25 to 50 billion white blood cells thrown out into the garbage can. And after 30 days of this, you're down to about 4 billion a day going out. How does all this help you? Why, sure, you don't have enough white blood cells now to die because you don't have enough oxygen in your blood and create all this stomach juice that comes out of the little bodies. That's a fine way to help you. And then, of course, you can always give someone gold salts. How do gold salts work? Well, gold being abnormal in the body, the little white blood cells eat these. It stores in their stomachs, but it's indigestible, and it fills their stomachs, and there's nothing they can do. They're out of commission then. So this helps the white blood cells get out of commission. In every way, it's to put the white blood cells out of commission, destroy their activity. In the same way, cytotoxic cells, cell-killing drugs, are used to control the problem. People take drugs like chlorambucil that are used to destroy white blood cells. And that's a good idea, of course, because the more white blood cells you destroy, the less you feel the pain of arthritis. But that has a side effect because many people have taken these cell-killing drugs over a period of years, suddenly develop an acute leukemia, which is a bad price to pay for a relief from arthritis that doesn't solve the problem. The only relief, the only hope you have for arthritis is to, one, go on a decent diet. Go on a diet such as I recommend to you of low fat and low cholesterol, and your gas will drop. That'll take care of gouty arthritis. You'll have a max amount of oxygen in your tissues. That'll take care of the rheumatoid and osteo. And I'd like to just give you an idea. An article that was reported, a study that was reported in the 1890 Journal of the Australian Medical Society. When people out there got arthritis, they go to a particular hotel, and they'd wait there until a whale was caught. And the whale was caught, and then they would be brought out to the whale works. And the whale would be given a single slice, just like you open up a hot dog bun, a long slice through the body. The whale would be open. The people would come in and sit in that whale up to their waist. Then the whale would be closed, and they would sit in that steam bath in that whale to help their arthritis.
At least that did no harm. Arthritis is bad enough, but how about gallstones? I don't think anyone who's ever described the pain of gallstones can say that, honestly can say, that it's not the worst pain one could almost experience. Now, gallstones are a real problem, and yet it's very prevalent in the United States today. I think that probably 10 to 20 million people have gallstones, whether they are symptomatic or not. It's a major industry in our country. Would you believe that 500,000 people are operated on each year to have their gallbladders out? And it's no fun either, because out of the 500,000 operations, 10,000 people die as a result of the operations. So gallstones is something we have to look upon very seriously. How do gallstones start in the first place? Well, first, I have to acquaint you with bile, because that's at the bottom of this. Remember that the liver makes bile, which is a digestive substance that helps digest fat. And that people that eat a lot of fat produce a lot of bile. Now, bile is made up of three principal substances. It's made up, first of all, of cholesterol. And then it's made of bile acids. And then it's made of a particular kind of fat called a phospholipid, sort of a slippery kind of fat that helps keep the bile and the cholesterol in solution with the bile acids. Now, if you have too much cholesterol in the bile, the bile acids and the phospholipids can't keep it in solution. It's like putting too much salt in water. When you put too much salt in water, you have a certain amount of salt that stays at the bottom of the cup and won't dissolve. And it's the same way with bile. If you have too much cholesterol, the cholesterol will dissolve to a certain extent, and then the rest that can't dissolve lays there in the form of crystals. And once you have cholesterol crystals, like little needles, laying in the bile, you know it's going to be not very long before the crystals stick together and it's like a snowball, start to form a little bile gallstone, a little cholesterol gallstone. Now, in populations where cholesterol gallstones are never found, and in animal studies, if you took a measure of the amount of cholesterol in the bile, you'd find it'd be about 300 or 350 at the maximum milligrams percent cholesterol. Remember, in your blood, we like to have your cholesterol less than 160. Well, in your bile, we like to have it less than 300 or 350. How much do you think it is in Americans? The average cholesterol level in the bile of Americans are 600 to 900. Can you imagine having a 900 cholesterol in your bile? No wonder the cholesterol comes out in solution and forms stones. In animal studies, animals, of course, never have gallstones in their natural diet, but if you give them high cholesterol diets, like Dr. Taylor has done of Northwestern University, they form gallstones just like people do. And what he did also was to give them a very large amount of lecithin, because some people say, well, lecithin helps dissolve cholesterol problems. He gave them a large amount of lecithin that had no effect whatsoever on the gallstones. But when he cut down the cholesterol from their diet, the gallstones dissolved. In human studies, we find very much the same sort of idea. Human studies, Pima Indians have a lot of experiments done with them because they have more gallstones than anyone in this country. In fact, if you're a Pima female, 25 years or older, 3 out of 4 already have gallstones. I think that taking out the gallbladders must be the largest industry in the Phoenix, Arizona area where the Pimas are. It's an epidemic there. And in studies on the Pimas, when they go to have their gallbladders out, one study let them be off all cholesterol for a short period of time, 2 or 3 weeks. Now, before they took them off cholesterol, they took samples of the bile, and they found there were many cholesterol crystals floating around. They took them off cholesterol completely for 2 or 3 weeks, and all the cholesterol crystals then were dissolved. They couldn't find any. Now they put them back on 2 or 3 eggs a day for 3 weeks. And that was enough in 2 or 3 weeks to have all the cholesterol crystals come back. So that it's very clear to see, if we want to dissolve the cholesterol gallstones, we better cut down the amount of cholesterol. And we've had some patients buy x-ray of their gallbladders and of their gallstones show that our kind of diet on low cholesterol can actually dissolve gallstones. But if you go to Mayo Clinic, you'll have a different approach. There they give you bile acids. They say, after all, the reason you have cholesterol gallstones is because you have too much cholesterol for the amount of bile acid you have. So what's the solution? To cut down cholesterol? Oh, no, we won't want you to change your American diet. The solution is to give you more bile acids. And if the body won't make them, we'll feed them to you. And that's what they did at Mayo Clinic. They fed people bile acids a couple of times a day. And that did, over a period of a couple of years, dissolve the smaller gallstones. But the moment they stopped taking the bile acids, the gallstones grew right back because they didn't change their diet. They've been trying this approach now for about a dozen years. And finally, they're starting to realize that diet is more important than feeding you bile acids. Kidney stones are a very painful problem that happens in many people. And in our country, kidney stones primarily happen because your uric acid level gets too high. And many physicians have tried reducing uric acid level, and they do it by using drugs to reduce uric acid level. And this cuts out the formation of stones almost at once and does it for as long a period as the drug to lower uric acid level continue to be taken. There's a much more practical way to do it, and that is, on this kind of diet, uric acid levels normally go down to levels that would not cause kidney stones. We've had a number of stone formers that came into our program that no longer form stones. It's your best bet. Get your uric acid down by natural means. So we find that gallstones, as painful as they are, and as bad as they are completely avoidable. These cholesterol gallstones that we have in our country never should be. It only comes from eating too much cholesterol and having too high cholesterol in your gallbladder. But unfortunately, in countries like the United States and other countries on the high-fat diets, hearing gradually deteriorates all through your lifetime, so that by the time you get to an age, 40, 50, 60 years old, where now you've made enough money and you've secured enough in life so you can enjoy all the things you wanted to, and you've always enjoyed good music, you can forget it because you've lost your ability to hear the high-frequency tones. It doesn't have to happen to you. And let's talk a little bit about hearing. First of all, is it something that must happen with age? Well, in our country, it does happen with age. You gradually lose your hearing. But in other countries around the world, that doesn't happen. For example, a study was done with those who attended a Wisconsin State Fair. Well, that's the dairy capital, and we know they have plenty of fats and cholesterol in their food. And they were matched with a group in Africa, the Mabian tribe. Now, the Mabians are on a diet very similar to one that I recommend. And when they were matched with them, they found that a 70-year-old Mabian had as good hearing as a 20-year-old Wisconsinite. And by the time a Wisconsinite got to be 30 or 35, his hearing was so bad already that there wasn't a Mabian old enough to be able to have hearing that bad. In Wisconsin, for example, when you get to be 40, 50, 60 years old, your hearing is so bad that you require a sound 100,000 times louder than you would for a Mabian to hear the same frequency. Hearing drops very fast on the American kind of diet. It's not only our country. Any large city that has the high-fat diet is the same. Studies have been done around the world in the large cities, and they find that almost all the large cities have the same kind of pattern of hearing loss. Now, in Finland, they did a study versus the population of Yugoslavia. Finland was picked out because East Finland has the highest cardiovascular death rate in the world, so we know that their vessels close pretty fast. And in East Finland, where the study was done, the average level of an adult is somewhere around 290 cholesterol, awfully high. Now, in Yugoslavia, the average adult level is about 180. And when studies were done of young people in these two countries, 10 to 19 years old, already you can see that in Finland, the young people are starting to lose their hearing in the 16 and 18,000 cycles per second frequency. But by the time they got to be 20 years old, those in Finland had an enormous loss of high-frequency hearing. That is around the 18,000, 16,000, and they're already starting to lose 14,000 cycles per second, whereas those in Yugoslavia were hardly losing any hearing at all. So even in young people, we can see it starting from the time they're 10 years old. Now, they did a study area of Finland and Scandinavian countries in mental hospitals. They took two mental hospitals that had exactly the same kind of hearing response in the 40 to 50-year-old age group. And they took one hospital and they put them on a diet where they only had half as much cholesterol and about 15 to 20% less fat. And it only took 3 years for the difference in hearing to show up. The hospital on less fat and cholesterol had improved 10 years in hearing, or you might say that the hospital with a normal diet had gotten 10 years worse. In any case, they were 10 years apart. The hospital with the normal amount of cholesterol and fat had hearing that you would expect of someone 10 years older compared to the group in the lower fat and cholesterol hospital. Yet their hearing was identical when they started. So we know in actual tests that if you lower your fat and cholesterol, you can keep your hearing from deteriorating. It's very important to get blood flow to the hearing organ. And the principal reason why your hearing starts to go is because you diminish your blood flow. The little artery that feeds the hearing organ starts to get narrower and narrower and diminishes blood flow. To show you how sensitive the hearing is, we can test it in smokers. In a large study in the Topeka VA Hospital, Topeka, Kansas, where they classed 120 smokers against 129 non-smokers, in every case the smokers had worse hearing at the same age group, both total hearing loss plus in the high frequency ranges. In fact, I can almost tell you that if you're a smoker and you stop smoking in 2 weeks' time, you'll be able to hear high frequency tones 2,000 cycles a second better than you can hear today at the same decibel range. In fact, in a test to show that the loss of hearing is principally due to blood flow or oxygen factor, about 14 people, of which half of them were completely deaf, were put in a hyperbaric oxygen chamber. Now, that's a chamber where they force oxygen in such pressure it goes right into your tissues, even though you don't have the blood flow for it. And it's amazing that half of these people that were deaf had their hearing restored for the short time while they had the oxygen in the tissues. It's amazing what oxygen can do even though you haven't heard for a long time. Now, if you'd like to have oxygen at the highest level possible, then you have to go on the diet that I recommend, because it certainly gives you the highest oxygen carrying capacity for your red blood cells. And you got to be careful that you don't get near smokers, because if you're near a smoker, you can breathe in 50% of the carbon dioxide that they breathe in. Your best bet for having your hearing maintain in good shape for the rest of your life is to stay on a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet and stay away from smokers. Sight is one of our most precious senses. You can ask anyone who's blind and they'll tell you about that. But would you believe that 50% of all blindness comes from circulatory problems? The problems come from plaques breaking off. These cholesterol boils in your arteries, they break off and they block off certain segments of the circulation of the eye. In fact, if you're an ophthalmologist, an eye physician, and you look into the eye, you can actually see the little cholesterol crystals breaking off and shining like a diamond right in the circulation of the eye. When that happens, you know that the person, if they don't change their way of life, is in for real trouble. In fact, on a study just determining life expectancy on people with these little crystals flashing in their eye versus those who didn't have any, in a 10-year period, those who did not have any crystals flashing in their eye, 70% were still alive. This was in a 50-year-old age group. But those with crystals flashing in their eye, instead of 70% still alive, only 30% were alive. It's bad news when you have these little cholesterol crystals breaking off, because that's what causes strokes. Now, if the little crystals break off and they block off just a portion of the eye circulation, you lose the sight in the area where it's blocked off. And that gives you partial blindness. And we picked that up in what we call a visual field test. Now, if you have a large enough plaque break off, or a cholesterol group of crystals, to block the whole little vessel, the central retinal artery, bringing blood into the eye, now you have total blindness. And there's no pain at all. Suddenly you see and suddenly you don't see. That's when a plaque breaks off and completely blocks the blood flow. And that's a tragedy. Many people suddenly have sudden blindness, and it's because a cholesterol particle broke off and blocked circulation. Now, the first signs of this you can pick up by looking at your friends. And you'll notice right around the iris of the eye is a little semicircle. It's a grayish-whitish circle. We call that arcus senilis. That means arc of age. But now we're seeing it in 20-year-olds, so we know it doesn't have anything to do with aging. You may not see it as a complete circle. You'll see it as a part of a circle, a little grayish-whitish circle that seems to follow the iris. Sometimes you have to lift the lid to see it. It's only on top. Sometimes it's at the bottom, sometimes on the side. Now, this grayish-whitish circle is an invasion of fat and cholesterol. When the body has so much fat and cholesterol in it, there's hardly any room left for it, it invades into the cornea of the eye. The cornea is a part of your eye you can put your finger on and touch. It's a clear area that protects your eye. And it invades in there, and it looks like it's right over your iris. Now, animal studies have indicated to us that when you have that in your eye, that grayish-whitish little circle is filled with cholesterol. In fact, when you have that in your eye, you've got as probably 40 times more cholesterol around your cornea and around your iris than you would have if you did not have it. One out of 40, and when you're 40 years old, that is one out of three over 40 years old, have arcus senilis in their eyes. After I'm through with the lecture, you can look in your eyes and see if you have it too. If you're over 40, you got a one out of three chance to get it. In animal studies, when we develop arcus in animals by feeding them high cholesterol diets, the tragedy is that not only do they have a lot of cholesterol in their eyes, but they have it in their arteries. Arcus in the eye means high cholesterol in your arteries. One study on rabbits, when they had high arcus in their eyes, they also had 10 times more cholesterol than the normal rabbits had in their big aorta artery. And they also developed a lot of plaques. So an arcus is something you wouldn't want to have, and hopefully you can stop the progression if you do have it, and it's hopefully can be reversed if you stop eating cholesterol. Now, in studies where people have had arcus, in Scotland, for example, they did a study and found that those who developed arcus earlier had heart attacks as much as 10 years earlier. In fact, those with heart attacks in their 20s and 30s and 40s had many more arcuses than those who did not have heart attacks. So arcus, obviously, the high cholesterol in the eye means high cholesterol in your arteries, which can give you a heart attack sooner. The tragedy, of course, with high cholesterol is not only for sudden blindness, but is also for inability to be able to see clearly. And one of the problems with partial destruction of sight is what we call glaucoma. Glaucoma is a term that indicates increased pressure in the eyeball. We call that intraocular pressure. Normally, the pressure in your eyeball is no higher than about 22 or 24 millimeters. That's the same way we express blood pressure in your whole blood system. If you have a blood pressure, say, of 120, that describes the same kind of pressure as in your eyeball of 22 or 24. Now, that's as high as we like to see it. We normally like to see pressures in your eyeball less than 20. Now, the pressure in your eyeball sort of keeps your eye in shape because the eye is like a hollow ball, and the only thing that supports it is the whole inside part is made of sort of a jelly. It's called the vitreous body. And the vitreous body fills up all the space inside the eye, and that's what maintains its shape. Now, the lens sort of presses against that vitreous body, that bowl of jelly, and that's where the pressure comes from. And the reason the lens is pressing against it is because there is fluid between the lens and the cornea. That's the part you can touch with your finger. Between the part you can touch with your finger, the cornea, and the lens that you can see, there's just fluid between, like a little river. And it's in that little river where the whole problem of glaucoma starts. Now, the vitreous body, the big bowl of jello that fills up your whole eyeball, is pressing very gently against your retina. Because if we take your eye and look at it, it's almost like a tire. It's made of three layers. It's like if you think of a hollow ball, the inside of that ball is the retina. That's the part you see with. And the middle part of this three-layered part that forms your eye is called the choroid. That's the part that has tiny little blood vessels that feed the retina. And then the last layer is the outside covering of the eye called the sclera. That means the hard part, the part that protects all the rest. So if you can picture this hollow ball made of these three layers with the retina on the inside, and then filling up the hollow ball is this bowl of jelly, the vitreous body that keeps the whole ball from collapsing, keeps its shape. And then the lens right in front is pressing against the whole thing, sort of pressing a little bit of pressure that sort of keeps it inflated, like you keep a balloon blown up. Now the problem is, if you press too hard, you'll flatten all these little blood vessels that feed the retina. And if you flatten those blood vessels, it shuts off the blood flow and you're instantly blind. You can't see. So too much pressure is not good because those little blood vessels in the vessels feeding the retina have a pressure of not a great deal more than the pressure of the bowl of jelly against the blood vessels. Those blood vessels have to have a little bit more pressure than the jelly pushing against them, or else the jelly pushing against them could flatten them out and close them. So the blood pressure in the eye is sort of critical. What affects the blood pressure in the eye? The pressure of this lens against the whole bowl of jelly. Well, the lens has no blood vessels of its own, and so in order for it to get oxygen and to be cleaned out of all the waste products and everything, and to get its minerals and vitamins, it has to have a separate way to handle it. And the way that happens is that that middle layer, that choroid I told you about, leaks some nice clear fluid from the blood. It's filled with oxygen, filled with glucose and all the vitamins and so on the body, the lens needs. And it sort of gently flows into the lens, just like a river overflows the land. And it flows into the lens, and at the same time it flows, giving all this nourishing material, it washes out all the waste products from the lens. The lens is almost like an onion. It's in layers. And all these layers have to be cleaned out all the time and given new food and new oxygen. Well, that works fine. Now, the waste products, this little river of waste products that come out, flow into the place between the lens and the cornea. Remember, the cornea is a part you can put your finger on, that clear layer of your eye you can touch. There's a little river that goes on between the cornea and the lens. And the river gradually flows out through a drain pipe called the canal of Schlemm. Now, everything is okay, and in every canal, every little drain pipe has its little filter. Remember, in your sink, in your kitchen sink, you have a filter so the drain pipe doesn't get clogged? Well, that little drain pipe, the filter is called the trabecular mesh. Now, if the filter gets clogged, we can stop the flow going out. And if the flow doesn't go out for some reason through this little canal, the little drain pipe, the pressure builds up in the eye because the fluid keeps coming in, feeding the eye whether the fluid goes out or not. And if something keeps the fluid from going out, the pressure builds up, pushes against the lens, and you now have increased pressure in the eyeball, and it presses so hard it can flatten all your little blood vessels feeding the retina, and you can go blind, or you can go partially blind. Now, what creates these problems? First of all, cortisone makes your tissue swell. And this little filter I told you about, it looks like a little meshwork. It looks like a screen on your window, a tiny little holes, and not to let any large particles through. Two young ladies were wearing contact lenses, and they abused their eyes a little bit and irritated their eyes. So they went to their eye doctor, and they said, well, I better give you some cortisone drops to relieve the inflammation. Gave them the cortisone drops, and the cortisone went right through the cornea, right into that little filter, that little trabecular mesh that keeps the large particles from getting down the drain pipe. And the little meshwork swelled because cortisone makes tissue swell. It makes them hold water. And when the little filter swelled, all the little holes became so tiny because the tissue swelled and made the holes get smaller that almost no fluid can go through. These two 18-year-old girls developed then glaucoma. Too much pressure in the eyeball because their drain pipe now was narrowed down from the filter being swelled. Now, how does that happen in people that don't take cortisone? How does it happen that pressures rise and create the glaucoma condition? Well, one way I think it happens is that the body itself can make more cortisone than it should, because the body and the adrenal gland makes cortisone. And the reason the body makes more cortisone than it should is if you have too many fats in the diet. Because too many fats cause a sort of chain reaction that forces the body to make too much cortisone. And if you do that, you can make your little filter, your tubercular mesh swell and close its little holes so the drain pipe can't get enough fluid flowing out, and that'll raise the pressure in your eyeball. And when that happens, you're going to have to take drops. You know those drops people take when they have glaucoma? They're called miotics. And what the drops do is force the little drain pipe to let more fluid go through, to lower the pressure. Now, sometimes drops don't work, so what then do doctors do? Well, they go into that drain pipe, and they go into that little tubercular mesh, the filter, and they slice big slices in it. So if the little holes aren't big enough, they put big slices, so now fluid can go through. What if that doesn't work? Well, then they go into the drain pipe where they chisel, and they chisel a big hole, and they stretch the opening to get more stuff to go through. What if that doesn't work? Well, then they have the last thing that does work, of course. They go in your cornea. That's a part you can touch, and they drill a hole right into the chamber between the lens and the cornea so the fluid can drip right out, right into your tear ducts. It just looks like you're crying all the time. And now any amount of fluid can get out. Does that work? Well, it works fine as far as dropping the pressure, but what happens to your per eye? Well, when you lose all that fluid, and you lose fluid when you have the eye drops too, now so much of this nourishing fluid leaves the area that there's not enough for your lens. It drains out so fast your lens can't get enough of the waste products cleaned out, and it can't get enough of this nice fresh oxygen and food in the blood. So your lens suffers terribly. For those who take drops, the sad news is that they have four times as many cataracts as those who don't take drops, because the lens suffers by having all this nice fluid drain out faster than it needs to, and so the lens doesn't get all of its waste products cleared away. How about when they do the operation? When they do the operation, it's a tragedy. Instead of four times as many cataracts, you'll have 10, 15 times as many cataracts with the operation, because so much fluid is lost there that the per lens just gets clogged up with all its waste products and becomes cloudy, and then you can't see. So, unfortunately, the only treatments we have increases the amount of cataracts. So you're paying a price. You're paying a price to lower the pressure in your eyeball because you want to stay on your regular American diet, and you're paying a price of developing cataracts. There are populations around the world that are on the kind of low-fat, low-cholesterol diet I recommend. I'd like to tell you that glaucoma and cataract are never found. Yet in our country, once you're 60 or 70 years old, 5 to 10% of the whole population has glaucoma, too much pressure in their eyeballs. It's very nice to know that the very same diet that's good for heart disease, breast cancer, colon cancer, arthritis, diabetes, gives you an extra bonus. It's also good for saving your sight. To summarize the information that I've given to you, I'd like to say that the American diet, which is something we're brought up on and something we're taught to love, our mother said is the best thing for us. The food manufacturers tell us we have to eat it. Just how good is it for us? Well, the American diet is 43% fat, 22% sugar. Two-thirds of our calories are completely wasted in fat and sugar. Very little in the way of foods as grown that have all their complements of vitamins and minerals. The American diet is high in salt, 50 times what the body needs. That floods our tissues with water, creating edema, creating the prerequisites for arthritis, high blood pressure, and their many problems. A tremendous amount of chemicals in prepared foods. Over 3,000 chemicals added to our food. Since 1945, over 1,000% increase in just food colorings alone. Prepared foods are a disaster. You've got to start getting your foods right as grown. Beans and peas, you can get them dried as grown. Potatoes, get them as is. The whole grains, without being destroyed by the food manufacturers, where they refine and take out the vitamins and minerals and so on. The other thing, of course, you have to be careful of is the high cholesterol in the American diet. The body simply cannot handle the load of fat and cholesterol the American diet offers. It destroys the body's functions by creating the cholesterol boils that we know as heart disease, by closing off the fine vessels, the coronary vessels that feed the heart and all the other vessels in the body. That's why we have senility many times at an early age, 40, 50 years old. Already people are losing their their brain capacity, they're having difficulty in concentrating and memory and so on. And then the high protein diet that's pushed in our country. First of all, because animal protein has no dietary fiber, you're doomed to constipation, because without dietary fiber, you can't have normal movements. The diet is so low in bulk that Americans have just very tiny, hard stools, whereas in other countries, constipation is unknown. Constipation, of course, gives you other problems like hemorrhoids, and the kind of diet encourages the colon cancer problem, diverticulosis, the colon diseases, ulcerative colitis, spastic colon, all these things so completely unnecessary. The diet that I recommend to you, the low-fat, high-complex carbohydrate diet, almost 80% in carbohydrates, is the very best thing for you in the way of energy. You get the max amount of endurance. Just remember those Tarahumara Indians running 150 miles. When you get up to 150 miles and you feel you'd like to have some extra advice, let me know and we'll get you up to 175 miles. There's no question that the diet not only protects you and prevents you from having heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, arthritis. We're understanding the role of diet to colon, prostate, and breast cancer. We even realize that even lung cancer, which we thought was a smoker's problem, turns out to be greatly influenced by the cholesterol in your diet. We begin to see that there are so many benefits to this kind of program, this dietary program, that if you want to leave fear away of the degenerative diseases, and more than that, if you really want to enjoy food the way nature intended it, you don't have any alternative. You really should get on this kind of diet and stay in this diet for the rest of your life. It frees you of the fears of degenerative diseases. Remember that degenerative diseases, diseases that come as you get older and so-called degenerate, are completely unnecessary. They're never found with primates. They're only found with people that are on the high-fat, high-cholesterol diet. And there's a nice thing about this diet, too. If you're a family of four, you'll save $1,500 a year in your food costs. I think that's the only disadvantage I can think of, because it's going to affect the food industries. It'll cut their profits, but it'll increase your health.